We are beginning this session with some introduction. There are things in chapter 1 which you'll need to read during the week, and then there are questions for you to answer, just like the last time we did a study out of Baptist Way Press out of Texas. So we really won't get into chapter 1 in the book tonight, but next week we will talk about it. I'll add some things to what you read, and I'll get you to kind of tell me, anyone who would like, you don't have to do that, but to have some discussion about it. But tonight I want to talk a little bit about Paul and about the influence of Romans, as well as a couple of introductory things about the book of Romans itself. Now, we've said before, but I will ask the question and see who remembers other than me. We've said before why the letters of Paul are arranged the way that they are. Can anyone remember what we said eons ago? Absolutely, thank you. Length, longest to shortest. The first one chronologically was 1 Thessalonians, about 50 to 51. Romans is probably written somewhere around 56 to 57, as Paul writes during this time. So when we come to that, we find not only that it's the longest of Paul's letters, but we also find that it's one that is filled with a great deal of theological argument, some cases diatribe, as well as ethical implications on that. Now, I know some folks don't really like Paul. Some folks dislike him more than others. They're rightly said by a number of folks over the decades, the Christian church in its practice and in some of its theology owes more to the Apostle Paul than it does Jesus himself. The Gospels are about the life of Jesus, the life and his teachings. The epistles focus on how to live a Christian life in a hostile world, more so. Charles Talbert, former colleague a long time ago of mine, wrote, and I quote, "The Apostle Paul occupies a tenuous position within the canon of many modern people. The distaste of people like Ernst Renan for Paul in the 19th century has its parallels today." And I'm going to read a quote from Ernst Renan at this particular point in time. Theologian in the 19th century, Ernst Renan, on his History of the Origins of Christianity, in that book on Paul, he says, "After having been for 300 years the Christian doctor in an eminent degree, thanks to Orthodox Protestantism, Paul seems in our day near the end of his reign. Jesus, on the contrary, is more living than ever. It is no more the Epistle to the Romans, which is the recapitulation of Christianity. It is the Sermon on the Mount. True Christianity, which will last eternally, comes from the Gospels, not the Epistles of Paul." Tell that to people who preach from Paul's writings every Sunday. "But the writings of Paul have been a danger and a stumbling block, the cause of the chief faults of Christian theology." But he goes on to say why. "Paul is the father of the subtle Augustine, of the arid Thomas Aquinas, of the somber Calvinist, of the ferocious theology which condemns and predestinates to damnation." Renan was not a fan of Paul. Well, I've got a book in my office I'll let you read. Ernst Renan was actually part of the 19th century quest of the historical Jesus movement. Well, it's a little print and no pictures. And it's about that thick. So, but there are a lot of folks today who, like Renan, did not like Paul and do not like Paul. He's often dismissed both for his theology and his ethics. On the one hand, Paul's theology runs counter to the dominant cultural trends. For many persons, it is easier to adapt the historian's Jesus to the norms of political correctness than Paul. In other words, Paul's not politically correct. Not only then, even today, Paul's not politically correct. His teaching about justification apart from law is viewed as a doctrine directed against Judaism. On the other hand, a misreading of Paul's positions on women and a correct reading of Paul's stance on homosexuality have gained him the hatred of many feminists and pro-homosexual advocates. Even those who do not openly oppose Paul denigrate him by neglecting his works. End of quote from Talbert. And that's very true. Another New Testament theologian, Ernst Casimon, writes about Paul. This Paul remains confined in seven letters and for the most part unintelligible to posterity, not just to the ancient church and the Middle Ages. However, when he is rediscovered, which happens almost exclusively in times of crisis, there issues from him explosive power. It is never long to be sure until orthodoxy and enthusiasm again master this Paul and banish him once more to his letters. However, the church continues to preserve his letters in her canon, even though they disturb her because he is so important. So you got Renan on the one hand who says, forget Paul, I hate Paul, get rid of Paul. And you got Casimon on the other hand, who is actually a better scholar, who says, well, yeah, people don't like Paul and sometimes we ought to not pay attention to some of what Paul says. But then again, when times of crisis come, suddenly Paul is the one that we need to listen to. So, and it runs all the gamut in between. However, Augustine, St. Augustine or Augustine, depending on how you learned about him, when he was struggling with his sexual addictions, said in his book, The Confessions, and Augustine, before he became a Christian, was as debauched and depraved as anybody ever was. Augustine in his confession says, if it was out there to try, I tried it. If it was out there to do, I did it. And I got to the point to where I couldn't stop. His mother was a Christian. She prayed for him all the time. But Augustine, when he was struggling, said that at best he could pray. This comes from his confessions. He said, at the very best I could pray, give me chastity and continence, O Lord, but just not yet. Until one day he picked up Romans. And he just kind of picked up the book of Romans and he let it fall open and it fell open to Romans chapter 13. And when he looked down, his eyes hit chapter 13 verses 13 and 14, which says, let us conduct ourselves becomingly as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarreling and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provisions for the flesh just to gratify its desires. Augustine wrote, no further would I read nor needed to. For instantly at the end of this sentence, that is verse 14, by a light as it were of serenity infused into my heart, all the darkness vanished away. So here he was filled with debauchery. One day he picked up Romans, I think encouraged by his mother to pick it up, let it fall open, read those verses, and immediately changed. Of course, now he went the other way as hard as he could to extremes. But Romans changed Augustine. Augustine was converted in 386 A.D. and he was baptized Easter Sunday, 387. That's what used to happen in the church a lot. People would convert. Yeah, I mean, you might convert in the day after Easter Sunday. And you would study and prepare yourself and live. You didn't get baptized until the next Easter Sunday. That was when they baptized folks in certain times in the church. Romans had done its work. Whereas other books didn't, because he had read other portions of Paul's letters, Romans did its work. Martin Luther. Always amazed me, especially these days. I used to offer extra credit papers in some, but you had to do the regular stuff too, in some courses. And in a couple of them, I would, you need to look at Martin Luther or John Calvin or Ulrich Zwingli or Smith and Helwys and do a brief paper on their importance. Well, you know what I started getting from students. If 10 students wrote about Luther, only two of them wrote about Martin Luther. The other eight wrote about Martin Luther King Jr. But Martin Luther was actually scared of God, even though he was a monk. He was a priest. He was scared of God. He was terrified of the Mass because he felt he could never be good enough. And he writes that he was accustomed to thinking of God's righteousness as something to be feared. Judgment, justice, destruction. But when he opened Romans and started reading in chapter 1, he got to verses 16 and 17, and he read, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live." Or his version of it that he read in Latin was, "The just or the righteous shall live by faith." And actually one of the legends about that is he was climbing the sacred staircase on his way to a meeting with the Pope. And according to, at that time, in the Middle Ages, according to not only tradition, but church law, if you were invited to go see the Pope, you kissed every step on the way up because those were the sacred stairs that led to the Pope's room. And as he started doing that, the legend is he had read these verses just before going there, and he starts climbing the stairs, and part of the way up, as he bent over to kiss one of the steps, that verse came, "The just shall live by faith." The next one, "The just shall live by faith." And after three or four steps, he said, "The just shall live by faith alone." He turned around and canceled his meeting with the Pope, which Pope didn't particularly appreciate. But he saw God's righteousness as something else, not to be feared, but as forgiving righteousness, by which, in mercy, God makes us just. Luther wrote, and I quote, "Then it seemed to me as if I were born anew, and that I had entered into the very open gates of paradise. The whole Bible took on a new aspect for me." He continued later about Romans. "This book is so important that every Christian should know it word for word by heart and occupy himself with it every day as the daily bread for the soul. Romans not only did its work on Martin Luther, but this letter of Romans changed not only Martin Luther, but changed those around him. And eventually, Lutheranism was born out of all of that." Luther never intended to start a new Christian church. But out of all of this, and out of the teachings, and out of what he learned, the Lutheran Church ended up being born. Romans highly influenced John Wesley. Some of y'all know who John Wesley is, or was, right? Methodism. And at that point in time, from the journey of John Wesley, where he talked about being in a meeting, and Romans was being expounded upon, and he said that famous phrase, "Suddenly I felt my heart strangely warmed." If you've ever been a Methodist, you've heard that from John Wesley's journal. Or you should have. He said, "I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone for my salvation. And an assurance was given me that He had taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death." End of quote. Once again, Romans, that particular letter, made that big a difference in John Wesley. Now, as I said before, some love Paul. Some hate Paul. Within the churches of ancient times as well as modern day times, he was worshipped and he was maligned. Some called him courageous. Some called him a coward. Some saw him as a true Christian and some saw him as an imposter, just a Jew trying to make a name for himself. He was unwanted. Even in the church in Jerusalem when he was first converted, he goes back and they didn't want him till Barnabas stepped in. And then he was welcomed. The second century church leader, Polycarp, revered him as one of the most blessed and glorious men that God ever created. Another Jewish Christian group said he's the devil incarnate. Y'all know what that where that group is, Ed? You'd have to die and go way back. Well, you would, yeah, that's right. You would think, you know, how if so many people despise him, how do these books end up in here? Turns out that more people listened to him and liked him than hated him. And over time, the church councils, as they met and prayed and debated and determined what went in the canon, determined that Paul had been such a big influence and continued to be such a big influence, and in part because Paul, he didn't lack in zeal. When he was persecuting Christians, he had no lack of zeal in persecuting and torturing and killing them. When he became a Christian, that same zeal just switched over to that side, and he put the gas pedal on the floor and kept going with it. And they thought, with all the persecutions, and he would stand up. He even invited persecution by going into the synagogues or going outside the synagogue to the philosophers and screaming at the top of his lungs if he had to, so the guys in the synagogue could hear him, so they could come out there and confront him. And then when he debated them to the point that they couldn't stand it, they'd drag him off and throw him in jail and have him beaten. And so they said, well, surely God was using him because of that, and so they should give a little bit more credence to what he had to say. And of course, you have the story, part of that too was the story about Ananias, when Paul was blind and Ananias being called by God, go and tell, he said, my mama didn't raise no fool, I'm not going there after that guy. He's arresting people and having them killed, and in the vision the angel said, in the book of Acts, in the vision the angel said, no, you go. I'm going to make him my missionary to Gentiles, and I'm going to teach him how much he must suffer. And so a part of that suffering, and they said, well, you know, Paul built a lot of churches, started a lot of churches, kept up with those churches, and this stuff kind of fits. Paul never, as far as we know, saw the earthly Jesus, though he saw the resurrected Christ on the road to Damascus before he went blind. But a lot of what he built in his theology and expanded upon came not only from his Jewish background and the foundation of Jesus' teachings, but what he had learned from others who had been eyewitnesses, from others who were Christians. And so,
his whole life was Damascus, pure tongue. I mean, every second.
Well, I do. Yeah, I do think, Ed, in some ways that after that, because he was trying to atone, and yet he comes down and he says, but I can't do it by keeping the law. And so he had that mission, and he was determined one way or another. And Paul would argue you up one side and down the other, and when he had to, he'd go into some of the rabbinic dialogues and monologues that he had learned and apply those to Christian teachings. And by the time it was over with, some of that rabbinic midrash he'd get into, you just wanted him to shut up because your head was spinning so bad. Paul is not an easy read. Paul is not an easy read. Yes, Jim?
Paul probably would have been in that group of Pharisees that were persecuting Jesus while he was
he was that kind of Pharisee, but as far as we can tell from church history, as far as we can tell from the writings of Paul, he never actually physically saw the earthly Jesus. And in fact, when he talks in 1 Corinthians 15 about Jesus and about his appearing after his resurrection and all this, and he says, and lastly, he appeared unto me as one untimely born. Basically, the understanding there is he's saying the only record that we have of him seeing Jesus was on the road to Damascus, the resurrected Christ. And so he said, you know, I was untimely born because I didn't get to see him. It's kind of how that's understood. Well, you really, as far as persecuting Christians per se, as he did, he probably had his appetite whet for that while Jesus was alive, hearing stories around. But he never really saw Jesus. But then once, you know, I'm sure that he, along with other, because Pharisees weren't just in Jerusalem, they were Pharisees all over the place. And he probably, and since he was from Tarsus, which is where he was trained, and there was a great university in Tarsus where all kinds of philosophies were out there, and that's where he learned some of his debating skills. That Paul probably in all of that thought, like the others, well, he's dead, this stuff's going to die. And then when it just kept bubbling up and spreading, it just made him more and more angry. I think Paul probably got more angry than Caiaphas himself had done. And Caiaphas is the one who said, we need to kill this guy. Or the Romans are going to come in here and destroy us and our holy place. And he says, do you not see it's expedient for you, talking to the Sanhedrin, meaning us, that is all the Pharisees, all the Jews, expedient for you that one man should die than that the whole nation should perish. And by a nation perishing, he was afraid the Romans would not only kill him, but he was afraid that the Romans would destroy the temple, the holy place, and therefore the religion would be devastated. And so Paul, when all this keeps going and going, Paul comes to Jerusalem and actually is present in Jerusalem, probably studying and preparing to go against these folks when we find Stephen being stoned. And that's the first instance of Paul showing up in the book of Acts in Jerusalem about 3 years after, 2 to 3 years after Jesus is crucified. He's in Jerusalem. These followers of the way are there. The first deacons are chosen. Stephen's the chief of those. He gets out there. He's debating. And at the end of when he's stoned to death, said, and they laid their coats at the feet of a man named Saul. And then in chapter 8, we find Saul breathing threats against them. And again in chapter 9, he's breathing threats against the church and having people arrested. So that just kind of, when he was present, and Stephen argued with the synagogues and then preached and said, this Jesus that y'all killed, he is the Messiah. The reason he was brought up before the leaders of the synagogue of the freedmen is because all these other guys would get out there, including Pharisees, and debate with Stephen. And Stephen turned their debates on their head. And preached to them. And so they brought him up. And lo and behold, they weren't even supposed to kill a man. They put a goat to death, but they didn't have the authority under the Romans to put a man to death. But when Stephen's preaching that day, the text says all of a sudden they began to growl against him. They didn't go, rah! But, you know, that's grumbling and mumbling. And they were the crowd. Mob vengeance, you know, how crowds can start that roar. And they rushed him, took him outside the city, and stoned him to death. Well, they weren't supposed to put him to death. I'm sure that they were a little bit, probably looking over the shoulders to make sure the Roman soldiers weren't going after him, because they were actually violating Roman law, occupational law, by doing that. So, you know, Paul really in earnest at that point decided, I'm going to do this. And so he went to the Sanhedrin and got papers giving him the authority that anywhere he could find Christians, he could have them arrested, tortured, and if possible, if necessary, he could have them killed. And he got where he really liked his job, because he thought, I'm stamping out this resistance. In fact, I think Paul had decided that if necessary, he would be a one-man wrecking crew. And he'd take them down all by himself if he had to. And when you get that kind of fanaticism going, it's hard to stop. But when he becomes converted to Christianity, what does he do? He goes whole hog after Christianity with the same kind of zeal, willing to put up with anything. Now, we do know that there were Jews all over the Roman Empire, and a number of Jewish Christians even in Rome. And this is written primarily to the churches in Rome. There were at least 5 house churches in Rome. They're listed in chapter 16. At least 5 house churches in Rome. This is around Nero is in power. Paul is killed somewhere in the mid-60s in Nero's Rome. This is written late 50s. So Nero is there. Claudius earlier had expelled Jews and Jewish Christians. In 160 B.C., Judas Maccabeus led a Maccabean revolt. Judas Maccabeus made peace with the Romans. There were lots of Jews who went back and forth between Jerusalem and Rome. In 139 B.C., Hispalus expelled all the Jews, all the Chaldeans, and the Asiatic astrologers from Rome. But then in 63 B.C., when Pompey conquers Palestine for the Romans, there are Jews back in Rome again. So, you know, they couldn't stop them from going. They were back in Rome, and a pretty good delegation of Jews. In fact, when Julius Caesar died, Roman Jews provided honor guards at his gravesite for several nights in a row. So they were kind of in good stead with Caesar. They probably did fairly well under Caesar. By the end of the first century B.C., in the time of Augustus, we find from Roman historians that Jews occupied large sections of Rome, and they were considered free Roman citizens. In A.D. 19, Tiberius, not James Tiberius, Kirk, no, Tiberius, the emperor, expelled Jews and followers of ISIS from Rome. But they came back again. And in 49 A.D., the emperor Claudius expelled Jews and Jewish Christians from Rome because, he said, they disturbed the public order. In fact, in that, Priscilla and Aquila were among the Jews that got expelled and then they came back. Now, you mentioned Nero. Under Nero, there were a lot of Jewish Christians in Rome. There were Jewish Christians like Priscilla and Aquila who followed Paul and Paul's teachings. There were others more in the mold of Christians associated with James from Jerusalem, the Jerusalem church, who was suspicious of Paul. There were also conservative Jewish and Gentile Christians. There were Gentile Christians who hated the Jewish ways and tried to push Jewish Christians out. And then there were those who followed the teachings of Paul, both Jew and Gentile. And I said there were at least five churches, house churches. In Romans 16, we're told of their meeting in the house of Priscilla and Aquila, the household of Aristobulus, the household of Narcissus. There's a cell called the Brothers, and another cell called the Saints. All five different house churches in Rome. And there was a lot of tension between them all. So, who was Paul? Paul was a Jew. Romans 11:1. He became a follower of Christ when Jesus was revealed to him. He mentions that in Galatians 1. He remained a Jewish Christian, building on a lot of the Judaism that had come about before. Romans, then, was written around 55, 56, 57, somewhere in that time period. At the end of his missionary journey in the Aegean Sea area. He was getting ready to take a collection to Jerusalem. Remember, he had taken up this collection for the Jerusalem church, which in some ways, Jerusalem church had gotten very poor, but in some ways it was also his way to try and make amends with James, because they didn't get along too well, and so he thought, I'll take up his collection and I'll go bearing gifts, and then James won't tell people that I'm to be held in suspicion. And we're told, though, that Romans was dictated to a scribe by the name of Tertius. I think that may be in your introduction, but it was dictated to a scribe by the name of Tertius. Around A.D., anywhere from 55 to 57 is where it's placed. There are a lot of scholars who think that this letter was actually delivered to the Romans by Phoebe. Romans 16:1, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, deaconess of the church at Synchrae, that you may receive her in the Lord as befits the saints and help her in whatever she may require from you, for she has been a helper of many and of myself as well. That he had this is his letter of commendation to Phoebe, who had helped him, was a fellow minister in the gospel, and he sent the letter by Phoebe to the Roman church. Now, within the book of Romans, Paul lays out a theology for a wide range of Christians. And that's one of the things that makes Romans so important. Christians from practically every background can find Romans and the theology and ethics of Romans instructive. Said Luther said, ought to be committed to memory. I don't know that I want to do that, but Luther said it ought to be committed to memory. He gives us three primary aims. The three primary aims of Paul in Romans. In chapter 15, verses 30 and 31, he says, I appeal to you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, to strive together with me in your prayers to God on my behalf, that I may be delivered from the unbelievers in Judea and that my service for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints. So one of his purposes in writing Romans, one of his purposes is to get the Roman Christians to pray for him as he goes to Jerusalem to try and make up. I want you to pray for me as I leave these unbelievers over here. He's in Corinth at that time, by the way, when he writes it. As I leave these unbelievers in Corinth, and as I head to Jerusalem with this offering, pray first of all that I'll be safe in getting away from the unbelievers. And secondly, I want you to pray. He says, I want you to pray here that I may be delivered from the unbelievers and that my service for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints. In other words, that James and Simon Peter will accept what I'm bringing. I'm not too sure that James and Simon Peter, whether they like Paul or not, would turn down the money. Especially since the church in Jerusalem at that time had gotten very poor. James, the older brother of Jesus, who became a leader in the church in Jerusalem. And James was actually martyred in the mid-60s, as was Simon Peter and as was Paul. So you got some of the real biggies being killed in Nero's Rome. I mean, you're looking at, and that's one reason why, and I happen to agree with him, Stephen Neal, who was a bishop in England at one point, but Stephen Neal, early last century, wrote a book, Jesus Through Many Eyes. And Neal posits that one of the reasons that the Gospels were written down is because the eyewitnesses are starting to die, and people are thinking, wait a minute, if these folks who saw Jesus die out, then how will we know? Because you got... Eventually, all of them, well, all but one was executed, and the other one died of natural causes, but eventually they were all executed in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I thought there was one that lived the longest.
John.
Really,
John. But John was shot with arrows. So, that's one of his purposes. A second purpose we find in chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. I long to see you that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. So, a second reason is his desire to meet with them at some point, but at least to write to them before he gets there, to give them a spiritual gift to strengthen them and unify them. As I said, there were five different groups that had a lot of tension. So he wants to unify them in this. And the spirit, what is the spiritual gift he wants to give to strengthen them? The gospel. He wants to give them the gospel. And that's why in chapter 1, we have the longest of Paul's greetings to any of the churches to whom he writes. And he lays out in it the basics of Christian belief. Verses 1 through 6. Most of his introduction, his beginnings, his greetings in the letters are only a couple of verses. This one's 6 verses long. And it lays out basic Christian belief. Because he hasn't been there yet. This is a church that Paul had not begun and a church that Paul had not visited as of yet. It's the gospel of the righteousness of God revealed in the faithfulness of Jesus that issues in salvation for all who believe.
So it wasn't like he was reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
No, because they hadn't been written yet.
Yeah.
But it's the gospel that he had received from hearing the eyewitnesses, from listening to others who had seen Jesus and preached, and from what he was learning. Yes, oral traditions, oral arguments. And it's for him, it's the gospel of the righteousness of God that's revealed in Jesus' faithfulness, which then brings salvation. That is the crux of that. And then the third reason, he wants to get the Roman Christians to help him get to Spain. He'll say in a couple of places that he's on his way and he hopes to get to Spain. Now, there's some scholars who think he did. Personally, I don't think he ever got there. I think he got killed before he got there, but that's neither here nor there at this point. The gospel eventually gets to Spain and gets to the British Isles because of Paul's influence. By the time the barbarians, the Goths and the Visigoths and all those folks, eventually by the time they get to the British Isles, there are already Christian churches in the British Isles. Probably started by Roman soldiers who had been stationed there, who had become influenced either by Paul or by Paul's disciples. And here they were in Spain. Churches were established, I think, primarily by followers of Paul, of Jesus and Paul's teachings. But we definitely are fairly certain that that's what happened in the British Isles. So even though he may not have ever physically made it to Spain, he got there. Trying not to break into a $3 night song about it. So I've never been to Spain. But I kind of like music. Yeah. The main theme of Romans, though, if you could narrow Romans down to its primary theme, it would be those verses 16 and 17.
Well, I don't understand how the Romans allowed Christianity to be
their soldiers.
Is this before Constantine?
It's before Constantine. Constantine's in the 300s.
Yeah,
early 300s, 318 or so, 326. Yeah. But one of the things that happened, we do know that when Paul did eventually make it to Rome, he was placed under house arrest for a while, and then he was allowed to go because he was a Roman citizen. That's what kept him from being killed outside of Jerusalem, was he appealed to Caesar, because being born in Tarsus, he had dual citizenship, a Jew and a Roman citizen. And so he appealed to that. And he gets sent, of course, he gets shipwrecked and almost doesn't make it, but then eventually gets there. But later in his life, before he was martyred, he was allowed some freedom to come and go. But before that, he was oftentimes in a room guarded by multiple Roman soldiers. There was a time period where he had a Roman soldier chained to him. Talk about maybe a fate worse than death, having to listen to Paul all the time. He had a Roman soldier chained to him while he was under house arrest, and the whole time, all he did was preach to that soldier and preach to that soldier. And we do know that within the Roman Empire, you know, Christianity kind of went underground in a lot of places, and if you were walking down the road and you happened to be talking to somebody, you were a Christian, and you didn't know, and it wasn't just Jews, but even Gentile Christians, you didn't know for sure whether they might be a Christian or not while you're standing there talking. If you wanted to talk about that, you just kind of take your foot and make half an arc in the sand. If that person didn't do anything, you knew you didn't need to go there. But if they happened to see it and they reached out with their foot or maybe a staff that they had and they completed it so it looked like a fish, you knew that you were with another Christian and you could talk. So You know, even within the Roman soldiers, that would happen. And I think some of the gladiators, Roman gladiators, became Christian, and then later they get out. You know, they work their way out of being a gladiator and spread that. But for Paul, I mean, if you had to listen to him all the time, eventually you might give up and give in just to get him to be quiet. But for him, this was the focus of Romans. The gospel of the righteousness of God revealed in Christ Jesus, which brings salvation. Charles Talbot writes, "It is above all concerned with about how God's saving activity deals with the guilt and power of sin in the lives of humans, and how that saving activity issues in Christian communal unity and ethical behavior. God doesn't save you just to be a lone ranger by yourself. God saves you to be in community and to be in unity of purpose. Not necessarily uniformity of belief, but unity of purpose in sharing that gospel. For Paul, the world makes no sense without the gospel. Daily life makes no sense without the gospel. One can't truly live and function as Christian without the gospel." But we have to, and sometimes it's tough to understand biblical passages, and especially Paul. One of the things we have to try and do is look at it in context, and that's part of what we will do. And we'll start in lesson one next time. Talbot writes, I was kind of hoping Susan was here. Talbot writes, because I think she would agree, and I wanted her to expound upon it, but words do not have any true inherent meaning. They only mean what they mean in context. Only in the context can we truly understand. By the same token, the only way we can truly understand this is to also look at it in context and then say, okay, how is that context similar to my life today? I mean, Romans deals with a particular historical situation, and in order to understand that, we have to try and understand the situation as well. And how that situation, in a hostile world, we think our world's hostile sometimes. The Roman Empire was very hostile to... They let the Jews worship God. But anyone who might be seen as a pretender or a threat to Roman authority and the Roman Caesar. And so, I hope next time I won't do all the talking, or as much of the talking. I didn't do all of it. But I would encourage you, read chapter 1. Do those exercises. Read the scripture passages with it. And let's talk some about that. What makes sense and what doesn't. And I know still when it's all over with, some of us might not like Paul, but we might have a new appreciation for what he does. Anything else? 10 till. Let me tell you, you might. Okay, God bless you. Thank you. Go in peace. Amen.